Okay. This is the third and final of the series that I called Cool Rabbinic Responsa, just as a way of getting the word cool back into public circulation. Also, because I don't know if anyone really cares if there's a theme or not. The truth is, there is a theme. I wasn't sure it was a theme that people would understand before I did it. So there's subtitles for those of you who want to find the common denominator. What I want to do tonight, to begin with, is to locate this this topic in the context of what we've done in the past 3 weeks, and I'll fill in for those of you who weren't here, right briefly, what it is we've done. And then also, I want to take a little bit of time to try and locate the whole series in the context of the Midrash as a whole. I try and explain what it is we're trying to accomplish, what it is you have unwittingly been part of, and which hopefully you'll decide that you really want to be part of. We did the first week, we discussed on halakha, but not only the impact of science on halakha, but we discussed the impact of a recognition of scientific, which was made at a time, right, when science was believed very different things than we believe today. Right, in particular, right, what do we do with a halakha which is decided, number one, based on certain on Aristotelian scientific premises, which we no longer accept, as to the, right, actually not even Aristotelian, some kind of peculiar, medieval, idiosyncratic position on the nature of volcanoes. And number two, based on a scientific reality in which you could not, in fact, devise Shabbat timers to accomplish everything in society, right? In which Shabbat timers could only accomplish very narrow things because the only Shabbat timers you had were the crude mechanical device of a 24-hour fuse, right, which you lit, and then at the end, right, when the fuse reached something, something was cooked. In the second week, we talked about the impact of abstract philosophic positions on halakha. Right, to what extent one's vision of the relationship between free will and determinism affects halakhic decision-making. We also talked about the question of to what degree you ever would allow a position that abstract really to affect your vision of law. Because you understand that positions like that are so mutable and so subject to controversy that it's very dangerous to let law rest on one's own conclusion as to the nature of, right, as to the absolute solution to a free will determinism problem. What we're discussing this week, in part, is going to be the impact of particular economic relationships and particular economic situations on halakhic decision making. With this, right, that's the context of this topic in the context of the previous shura. I want, in the context of the program as a whole, the program as a whole is designed to create modern Orthodox leadership, and it's based on certain premises. The fundamental premises I start from are, number one, if you're going to have a really serious, committed modern Orthodoxy, which is distinct, which has a unique identity as modern Orthodoxy, then you have to have modern Orthodox halakha. Right, you can't have a position which is purely, which has intellectual differences, which doesn't have nafkaminas, which doesn't have practical ramifications. And the second premise that I want to advance is that if you want to have a modern Orthodox halakha, it's not going to happen just by saying, okay, we're going to take the same sources, look at them in the exact same way, and magically we're going to come out with different answers. It's not going to happen that way. There has to be a modern Orthodox way of doing halakha for there to be a modern Orthodox halakha. Okay, we'll discuss at some other point, maybe this Shabbat, I'm not sure what the schedule is, what exactly it means to have modern Orthodox halakha. Does that mean, you know, does that have sectarian implications, how you balance the dangers of doing halakha differently with the need to actually express one's own ethical intuition properly, one's communal ethical intuition in halakha. That's not our topic for tonight. Right, but I just want to set that as a premise, that if there's going to be a modern Orthodoxy, there has to be a modern Orthodox halakha. If there's going to be a modern Orthodox halakha, there has to be a modern Orthodox way of doing halakha. Right? At least this summer, a lot of what we've been doing in the program, right, in the day part of the program, is trying to explore halakha, the process of halakha, to see if we can try and figure out, okay, what would it mean? What would it mean to do modern Orthodox halakha, or to do halakha in a modern Orthodox way? And I want to say that I think one thing that's going to happen, right, we don't have a conclusion, the program's only 4 years old, but what I want to, one thing that I think is certainly going to have to happen is the following, that when you call yourself modern Orthodox, whether, right, which without prejudice as to whether modern Orthodox is really the only true continuation of halakhic Judaism or some kind of legitimate graft on halakhic Judaism or some kind of alien plant, whatever you want, right, whatever you want to think about it, you're already self-conscious. Right? You already have an identity which is self-consciously non-static, which is self-consciously not saying, I'm just going to continue exactly what happened before. Okay, right? There's no way you can use the term modern without saying that. Right? Unless you want to define modernity as, you know, everything after 1850. Right? And say halakha froze as of 1850, and we're just continuing halakha exactly as of the moment it entered the modern era. Right? I don't think, you know, we're modern, but we're not postmodern, right? So we stopped at some point. Right? I don't think you want to say that. Which means, right, that you're conscious by consciously declaring yourself non-static. You're consciously declaring that there are things which have changed which are going to affect your vision of halakha. Now, I would argue that, in fact, halakha is always affected by external factors. But by calling yourself modern Orthodox, by calling yourself that way, you're stating up front that you're going to be self-conscious about those factors. Okay, so what I want to do tonight, we're going to build towards two responses of Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman. Now, Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman is a very important historical figure for one embarrassing reason and a number of really good reasons. The embarrassing reason that Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman is an important historical figure, despite the fact that he died between World War I and World War II, is that if you ask people, gee, is there an Orthodox response to Bible criticism? Yes, Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman. Because the last Orthodox response to Bible criticism was written by Rabbi David Zvi Hoffman before World War I, I think, even. Right, so he's an important historical figure because, to that degree, all forms of Orthodoxy have been completely static. We haven't said a thing in the past 85 years or so. But he's also important as a model, in many ways, of what the modern Orthodoxy could be. Somebody who was intellectually omnivorous and yet a tremendous Talmud Chacham, and is open about his intellectual broadness, not only intellectual broadness in the sense of happening to have an interest in entomology in addition to halakha, but also broad interest within Jewish sources, right? Interested both in historical academic Jewish studies and in studying Gemara by purely traditional means, with a very interesting introduction about what exactly the rationale for each of them is. Also, right, in that his tshuvot are very, very conscious of the social reality in which he lives. And so I want to build towards this tshuva of his, analyzing two things. Number one, the mode of argumentation he uses, and we'll see, that'll be very interesting to think of that, because you might think that he does radical things in terms of his method. He doesn't at all. I remember when we first discussed a tshuva of him in the program during the day, so I think a lot of people were astonished when you say, okay, Rav Zevi Zvi Hoffman, the great scholar, right, the omnivorous intellect, what's the first thing he does when you ask him halakhic shayla? The answer is, he looks at the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. And he rarely gets beyond that. Right, his first stage, first level answer is, look at the Kitzur Shulchan Aruch. When that doesn't work, he goes to the Shulchan Aruch and a few basic nosei kelim. If that doesn't work, he goes to responsa written by his teachers. Namely, the Maharam Shik, the Ketav Sofer, and Rabbi Israel Hildesheimer. So that's one thing, right? It's really interesting that, you know, that in terms of method, his initial response, he's willing to do things, right, in cases of first impression, in cases which his teachers haven't dealt with, in cases which aren't explicit in Shulchan Aruch, then all of a sudden you'll find him doing different things. But his initial response is basically, you know, take a look exactly at what tradition said. We have to figure out, right, it's worth thinking about precisely why that is. Okay, so what would the issue we're discussing tonight is the question of whether children can attend school on Shabbat. And by attending school, we don't mean yeshiva. And we're talking about German public schools, right, which are referred to variously as Gymnasia or Realschule. Right, I don't know what the difference between them was, but they're based, but they're German. They're I think free public German schools, right, which obviously have no Jewish component at all. And the question is, right, on what basis, right, on The German public schools obviously had school on Shabbat, right, because the teachers' union had not yet demanded a five-day work week. And the question was, right, what should children who went to these schools do? He doesn't consider For whatever reason, he doesn't consider starting a day school, right? Which in America nowadays we would say is, you know, the obvious response, right? Why should children be going to public school on Shabbat, right? But again, most of you are aware that that's a pretty contemporary American, you know, that right. Those of you who associate with Maimonides know that Maimonides was one of the first, right, maybe the first, and at the time it started, it was really a radical idea, and that in the non-Orthodox community, it's still a radical idea, which is just catching on. So that doesn't seem to have been an option in his mind. Right, starting an independent Jewish school system. What do you do with children going to school on Shabbat? So I had you do, and I think most of you did on your own, Talmudic sources relating to the question of what is permissible to talk and think about on Shabbat. Right, which there are a number of them. Right, we started with source number one, talks about the parental obligation to teach. To teach children professions, teach sons particular professions, in which the Talmud has a somewhat non-complementary vision of business as opposed to other professions, and that business being somewhat incompetent might save people from going off out and becoming bandits, whereas a good profession like being a tanner or a blacksmith, right, that'll always make sure that you'll have a living and you don't have to become a bandit. Right, so one source, there's a dispute about whether you should teach children any children profession specifically, or simply some means of making money, including business, and they can take their chance. Okay, it's based on a really interesting drasha, which I think has two components. That's source number two. The explicit drasha is Re'ei Chayim Imisha Asher Ahavta, that you should have both life and the woman whom you love. The woman whom you love can either be literal or it can be a metaphor for Torah. Right, because all wisdom literature in Tanakh is always right. All female characters, all good female characters, right, are interpreted as metaphors for Torah. And so it says Re'ei Chayim Imesha. So you have to have both, right? You have to have a living, right, and the woman whom you love. I think why do you get the idea that living refers to work? If you look at the end of the verse, right, the whole thing is talking about your portion in labor. So we assume that the context really is talking about work. Okay, right. So you know there's some kind of mitzvah to teach your child a profession. Right, then we have a mission of source number three, which talks about things that one is not supposed to talk about on Shabbat. The Gemara concludes that the notion that there are things which one is forbidden to talk about on Shabbat specifically is the position of Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha. Rabbi Yeshua ben Korcha learned from the verse "Nimtzoch Hashtucha v'daber davar" that it is forbidden to talk about certain things in on Shabbat, but it's legitimate to think about them. Right. So the mission which distinguishes between the Mishnah, which suggests that there are times when you can say something indirectly, everyone knows what you mean, but you don't say it, that's because of this distinction between speech and thought. Rabbi Yehuda ben Korcha believes there are certain things you can't think about on Shabbat. Okay, the Gemara then says, but there's a whole list of things which we would think are unShabbistic, which you're allowed to talk about on Shabbat. Right? You're allowed to go to assemblies to talk about public affairs, right? That's one that's very much in the news these days. Right, going to assemblies to talk about public affairs. You're allowed to make calculations as to how to divide charitable money. Obviously, you can save lives. Okay, and finally, you're allowed to arrange for children to be educated in a profession. Right, translated to be apprenticed. Okay, that's something which you're allowed to talk about. Which you're allowed to talk about on Shabbat, right? Presumably, because that's considered tefei shemayim. That's considered God's business and not just your business, because right, you have right, because important, right? God is interested in having your child not grow up to be a highway robber, right? So for that reason, right, arranging for your child to have a profession is in fact a legitimate occupation on Shabbat. Okay, right. This the notion, right? What's lacking in any of these sources, right, is a discussion of what exactly the context of Torah is. Right, well, of course, you're allowed to think about Torah. What does Torah mean? Right, so there are lots of different definitions of Torah. One definition of Torah is you have to read a Masoretic text. Right, Tanakh, Torah, Shvapet, something like that. Or you could use a really expansive definition of Torah. Right, you could say that Torah is anything which makes you feel closer to God. Right, Torah is defined by Maimonides in the opening of the laws of the fundamentals of Torah as including right physics and metaphysics. Right, basically all of natural science and all of speculative philosophy. Could have done that. Doesn't show up here. Okay, but maybe for no reason. Maybe for good reason, right? Maybe because that's included in Torah, so right. So nobody suspected you shouldn't be able to talk about those things. Who would suspect you couldn't talk about biology on Shabbat? Obviously, you can talk about biology on Shabbat. You're studying God's, right, the book of God's works, I think. The the Christian formulation is.
Okay.
The Shulchan Aruch, however, right, the Shulchan Aruch doesn't really make these distinctions, right? He just lists all sorts of things that you can talk about in Shabbat. He basically divides just about all literature into war stories and love stories. And he's against them both. Certainly, right, he's against them both on Shabbat. He says, on Shabbat he's against them because there's a specific problem of reading about these things on Shabbat. But of course, during the week he's also against them, right, because it's idolatry, it's incitement to Yetzer Hara, right, he immortalizes the Manual of Rome by using him as the example of erotic literature. I don't think anyone would read Manual of Rome if it weren't for the mention of the Shulchan Aruch. Their professor Septimus particularly, I think, has been known to teach it in class and as saying you have to understand Shulchan Aruch after all. But he basically disposes of all of literature that way. It's either war stories or it's love stories. And anybody who authors them, copies them, and Kal Vachomer prints them is someone who causes the multitudes to sin. Following which, the Rama comes up with an interesting line and says that only if you're reading them in a language other than Hebrew. But in Hebrew, some of this is okay. Why is it a different issue, right? Presumably because there's some kind of Kiddushah to Hebrew. Yes? I really don't know. Yes, Yeshua. Okay, right, there's a whole debate, and it seems also into this notion that there's actually a mitzvah to learn Hebrew. But there's also a great Rishonim who wrote secular literature in Arabic. I don't think the Shulchan Aruch cares so much about that. Maybe they only wrote it in Hebrew. Astrolabe is a device for studying the parallax of stars, I believe. Right, studying the movement of the constellation, the perceived constellation. That was impressive using the word parallax, but because I'm a big fan of Thomas Kuhn. His dissertation was on the Copernican revolution. Otherwise, no idea. I think that's right. Well, I think it's a cool word to use. If it's not, then somebody should raise the tape of it. Okay, then the Shulchan Aruch goes on, right? We're still in the middle of source four. It says it's forbidden to learn it, right? In addition to these things, it's forbidden to learn anything on Shabbat and Yom Tov, except for Torah, even books of wisdom. Okay, books of wisdom may be right outside of the category of fiction, which he disposed of earlier, or even non-fiction narrative, which he disposed of earlier. But there's some people who allow it. Okay, then Shulchan Aruch says, however, of course, things that are Chesed Shemayim are permissible, and among the things that are Chesed Shemayim, he says, right, this is the beginning of source number 5, it's permissible to teach a child some kind of intellectual discipline or a trade, right? And what does that mean? It means you can make arrangements for the child to learn them, says the Shulchan Aruch, but you can't actually have them learn the thing themselves. Okay, you can arrange for a child to be apprenticed, but you can't actually have the child learn the material on Shabbat. Okay. Yes.
Such as people who will read scientific literature or journals, whatever.
Probably.
Is it not
absolutely. Right. He says there are some people. Most. He says it's forbidden. And there is one, actually. He doesn't even say there are some. He says there is one who permits. So we'll see in a moment.
I'm not referring to the
love school of warfare. Right, no. All his opening statement is forbidden to learn anything on Shabbat except Torah.
Right.
And he doesn't count this as Torah.
Yeah.
He says to learn them. I'm not quite sure what it means to read something that you didn't know if you're not learning it. You know, just to proofread. I guess it'd be permissible to proofread it. By that. By that token. Okay, so now, okay, right, so that's where halacha is. Yes?
It doesn't seem clear from the Shulchan Aruch that you're talking about comparing
to teach the trade,
right? Well, the end of the first paragraph, first part, right? Only to speak about them, it's permissible to teach him something intellectual or a trade, right, to speak about that, but only to speak about them if they wish to be hired or apprenticed, not actually, right, to hire them out and mention specific amounts of money. Okay, you're right, he doesn't mention as opposed to learning either, right, he just says you can make the arrangements. He doesn't get to the question of whether the child can actually start studying on Shabbat. Right, he just talks about arranging it. All right, so you can arrange it, we know you can arrange it, but we know you can't learn anything but Torah, right, so that makes it pretty clear. That's l'shadech l'lamdo. Well, the next line makes it clear, right? The dafka. I think the next line makes it clear. Okay, right? So Shulchan Aruch, you know that you can make arrangements for a child learning profession, but you can't actually mention specific sums of money, and really you can't learn anything on Shabbat except Torah. Although some people think you can, one person thinks you can learn books of wisdom. Okay, that brings us to the only response that I can find specifically on this issue. And again, this is not, you know, a statement in my comprehensive knowledge of all rabbinic literature. There's only one response in dealing with this. It means the phrase, l'lamdo umanut, right, which we're talking about, shows up only in this response on the very long response of Project CD. So if you happen to know any other response, by all means, tell me. I don't claim that this is a comprehensive knowledge. Okay, so Rav Yaakov Emden, who also, by the way, is somebody who had really broad intellectual interest. Among other things, Professor Schneer Lyman is fond of commenting that he knew the New Testament by heart. But Rav Yaakov Emden was also interested in historical issues. He's famous as being the major traditional figure who challenges the authenticity of the Zohar. But on this issue, he's not very open at all. And he's dealing with the question of whether you can practice surgery on Shabbat to learn to be a doctor. And there's a long response in which he mentions the numerous problems associated with it. And at the end of it, he says, I don't think you can even avoid the problem of measuring on Shabbat, right? Though we saw in the Shulchan Aruch that there are measurements for mitzvah are permissible, right? He says, I don't think you can avoid the problem of measuring on Shabbat. And then he says, but you might say, look, this measurement, this whole profession is a mitzvah measurement, right? Because after all, it keeps people alive. And it keeps you alive. Right? And we know that Chazal, any number of times, are very lenient about making a living, right? They want people to make a living. And particularly a really good living like this, right? You become well respected, right? You make a comfortable living, and not only that, you save life. So we should say that that simply engaging in practice for medicine, right? Look, we're not talking now about actually assisting in operations where people's lives are actually saved. We're talking about engaging in operations for practice, right? So I don't want to bring immediate ramifications down to medical students nowadays. If you're just practicing, so you might say, look, right, this is of course something permissible. Right? When the Talmud says, that this is one of the obligations you have, is to have a living, right? Right, what could it be referring to? It's referring to a living like this. Right? So if you're allowed to engage a child to learn a profession on Shabbat, so of course you can learn this kind of profession on Shabbat. Right, so Rav Yaakov Emden says, that's what you would say. And then he goes into a marvelous rhetorical flight. He says, do not falsify your spirit and be entrapped by the numerous seductions and devils of the evil inclination, finding a place in your heart for these lying and counterfeit analogies. Okay, this is a bad, bad argument. Right? He says, even though we found they permitted arranging an apprenticeship for a child, they only permitted the arrangement, not learning the material on Shabbat with entering the profession. Heaven forbid, let such things not be done in Israel. Okay, so Rav Yaakov Emden is very, very clear that whatever permission you find only deals with arranging the education here. It doesn't deal with actually engaging in the education. Okay. That's, so far as I can tell, that's what Rav David Zvi Hoffman has in front of him. I'm not even sure he has the Sheilat Yavetz. I don't know. I'd be interested to run a search. I don't think he regularly quotes the Sheilat Yavetz. I think he'd have to look it up. It's not. There are a number of books he clearly knows by heart. I don't think that's one of them. So he has the Shulchan Aruch, and we at least know the one precedent which says the Shulchan Aruch doesn't extend to learning a profession. Now he's addressed it, right? Now Rav Emden is going to confront the question, can children attend the school on Shabbat? Okay, but first, there's a tangential issue. If children attend school on Shabbat, they don't go to shul. Right? Because school is during school is during shul hours. So even if you think it's a fine idea for them to attend school on Shabbat, you have to deal with what happens if they miss shul on Shabbat. So let's deal with response to number one. I don't know the order of Melamed Lehovil or the Sefer Tzviyachin collection, the Tshuvot are not dated. So I don't really know the order of them. I know the order in the book, but I don't know the order of the Tshuvot, and the book is edited posthumously, so I don't even know if it's the order that he wrote it in. He left it to be edited. His son writes in the introduction that he kept on looking for a bigger Talmud Chacham than himself to be the final editor. They kept on dying as soon as they accepted the job, so he finally decided that he should do it himself. But it's not really clear exactly what the relationship is to what Rav Zevi Tzvi Hoffman wrote himself. Okay, so he begins by saying, in Congregation of Israel in Berlin, my teacher of Israel Hildesheimer Zatzal decreed that for the sake of the children who could not come to synagogue before noon, there would be a Torah reading at 2 or 3 in the afternoon, at which they would have 7 aliyot, say the Haftarah with its blessings, then pray Musaf till its completion, followed by Mincha with its Torah reading. Although there are grounds for objecting to this, regardless, in Kvar Horah Zakein, an elder has already ruled. Okay, first to say that in all of Melamed Lehoyil, there is not one place in which Rav Zevi Tzvi Hoffman gives the slightest hint that he ever disagreed with Israel Hildesheimer. Right, so the first thing in terms of his method of thought is that absolutely his Rebbe, everything his Rebbe says is absolutely perfect. Okay, but here he tells you, right, there are grounds for objecting, but my teacher wins. Okay, Hildesheimer decreed a second Kriyat HaTorah. Interesting contemporary analogy, by the way, is that one of the Chabad shlichim in Israel, not Chabad, I think a Karl and Stollner actually had, right, part of the point of the story, was in some town in Russia, on Rosh Hashanah, and realized that most of the Jews couldn't come to shofar blowing in the morning because they wouldn't leave work. And so he wanted them all to hear shofar, right, and they all wanted to hear shofar, but they wouldn't come during the day. But if he decreed there'd be a special shofar blowing in the afternoon for the people who work, they'd all be too embarrassed to come. So he announced that there was a special minhag in Karlin Sullen of blowing shofar again in the afternoon. Right? And that was his excuse for having an afternoon shofar blowing to which everybody could come without fear of embarrassment, because after all, they're just fulfilling the Karlin Sullen minhag of blowing shofar again in the afternoon. I don't know if he had to do that. He could have just claimed that he was a brisker and the way they blow shofar in the morning, I was only Yotzei 3 days. There's a Gemara in Rosh Hashanah which talks about how when they blew shofar in Yavin, you couldn't hear yourself think because of all the individuals blowing. And Tosfot explains the reason that all the individuals were blowing is that everybody came late to shul, and so nobody actually heard all 100 kolot in shul, or 30 kolot, whatever it was. Everybody had to blow themselves later, which is an interesting sociological claim. Right, that in the time of the Gemara, everybody was late. But as Eldon pointed out, maybe that wasn't it at all. Maybe just they all thought they were in Yotzei with the Baal Kriya because he blew according to the wrong Shita. So he could have done that instead of the Karl and Stalin thing. So Israel Hildesheimer created this new Torah reading. Okay, and he says, look, the notion that you can read Torah in the afternoon comes from the Dagul Mirvava, which is the commentary of the Noda Bihuda on Rabbi Chesko Landau on the Shulchan Aruch. And Mishnah Berurah says exactly what the order is. But he tells you, look, all that's only if you missed once by accident. Right? What happens if your Sefer Torah was fussle and you couldn't get another Sefer Torah before the afternoon. Right? Or your Balkorei didn't show up and you didn't have anybody else competent. But to establish as a regular thing, nobody would suggest that you could establish a regular Kriyat HaTorah in the afternoon, or that you should regularly daven Musaf after Chatzot. However, he says, right, last paragraph in source number 7, says, but so that the practice of Torah reading should not be eliminated from the lives of the children who need to attend gymnasium and other schools on Shabbat, they decreed under duress to do this every Shabbat, and also to pray Musaf then with the minyan. Certainly the depth of the law does not support this decree, but it is time to act for God by annulling his Torah. Okay, right, that's the halachic elastic book, right? The best interest, right, the rabbis can act in the best interest of Torah. So now we know that he doesn't think, right, he thinks that going to gymnasium has at least one negative implication. It means that these children have to hear Kriyat HaTorah at an inappropriate time. Right, at least Rabbi Hildesheimer felt compelled to decree Kriyat HaTorah at a bidiavad time, right, at a less than ideal time, for the sake of these children attending a gymnasium. He doesn't tell you, right, whether Rabbi Hildesheimer tried desperately to talk his children into coming to shul at a regular time. And then when they wouldn't listen, so he said, okay, it's better to have them, right, it's better to have them It's better to have them come later than not to come at all. Yes.
Is it assumed also that they don't have to wait?
We're getting there. Okay, let's assume for now. Yeah. Assume for now. Okay. So right now we have the idea that as a result of the children who are attending gymnasium, he supports Rabbi Hildesheimer's bending the law. Right? And he describes the bending of the law in really strong terms, right? It's time to act for God by annulling your Torah. Very strong terms. And if you read that, you would get the sense he'd rather they didn't go. Right? Because if you have to pull out something that strong, it's just that once they're going, he has to react to it. Okay, then we get to the source number 8. Okay? Source number 8 asks the question directly. Right? Many Jewish children go to gymnasium school to learn the wisdom necessary in our day to earn a living. If they attend school even on Shabbat and carry the necessary books with them to school on Shabbat, must their parents object? Okay, it's an interesting formulation. The question is not should they. The question wasn't asked as should they go. The question is asked as do the parents have to object to their going, which is really interesting because it assumes a society in which, the children are making their minds up about these issues on their own. Yes. Sir? No. It means object to them. It's clear. Absolutely clear it's object to them. Absolutely clear it's object to them. I mean, you know, it can happen that, I guess, at a certain age, right, it may very well be that the German schools gave children the right. Let's say. Yeah, no, it's absolutely clear. It's absolutely clear it's a child. I mean, say in family history, so my grandfather objected to my father going to college. As a result, my father went to Cooper Union to start college instead of City College, because Cooper Union did not require parental permission, and City College did. Right? So, you know, there are times you can object when your child does, you know, when your child goes to college anyway. So maybe in Germany, you know, kids at a younger age had the right. Where parents were already losing that much control of their children. I don't really know what the German society was like in this life. Right, it may very well be, but if they tell, what happens, right, it's not necessarily clear, must the parents object, I don't know what happens if the parents object. Is it their obligation to do it, or the children will listen, or not? Well, that's not an option, it's probably not a legal option. It's probably mandatory education, and there are no Jewish schools. Right, so that's probably not a legal option, I'm not sure. That's probably not a legal option. You have to look up the list. Right? Okay. Maybe that's also an option also. He doesn't. Again, the question is not asked as whether it's permissible then to go. The question is phrased as, must the parents object? If it happens, he answers the question in this part of the tshuva about whether they should go or not. Right? The second half of the tshuva, which I don't give you, which is talking about carrying, he answers the question about whether they must object. Right? That's a much more technical discussion. Whereas here he's right on point. Whether they should or shouldn't go. Okay, so what he does is he cites the Shulchan Aruch. Shulchan Aruch says you can't learn books of wisdom on Shabbat. And he says the ordinary canons of legal decision making, right, according to standard halakha, if the Shulchan Aruch quotes one opinion straight and one opinion as there is someone who allows it, that means we don't allow it. Okay, so right, in terms of allowing the children to go just because right it's intellectual material, nope, sorry. Standard halakha is you can't learn secular stuff. Right, you can't learn books of wisdom on Shabbat. Okay, he says, however, that there's another rationale for allowing it, which is that the Shulchan Aruch allows for making arrangements for children to learn professions on Shabbat. Well, he says, we know children can't possibly advance in their professions if they don't graduate school. If they don't graduate with good grades in school. Children who miss school on Shabbat, right, are not going to have good grades because unquestionably the German schools are not going to review the material missed on Shabbat, right, for the Jewish children. Right, this, like my mother can tell you from her experience in Switzerland. Absolutely, they're not going. Right, the teachers were not at all sympathetic to Jewish children. You know, they weren't sympathetic. The Jewish children weren't compelled to write, but you certainly have to make up all the assignments immediately. And the notion that that school would wait for you certainly wasn't happening. Then he says, well, right, he says, it seems to him that this makes going to school a little bit of a mitzvah. And you're allowed to talk about things related to mitzvah. the mitzvah on Shabbat. Okay, that's a wild stretch. Right? That's a wild stretch. Talk about you can set up a long-term arrangement, therefore meaning that you can have a child spend every Shabbat, right, sitting in school, learning this material. Right? Let's deal with number one is the question of Yaakov Emden made a very reasonable point that making the arrangements is not the same as studying the material. Right? There may be totally different issues, right, as to making sure that he can learn a living and in the details, which could be done at some other point. But secondly, again, the difference between one Shabbat, having one conversation, and spending hours every Shabbat doing something, learning things other than Torah, that's a big stretch.
The other stretch is to say that the fact that they're forced to do it makes it a mitzvah. In other words, so if it's a mitzvah, then whether they're forced to go there to go to school on Shabbat or not should be...
Well, it's not because they're forced. They have to learn this material to make a living. This is the only way they can earn those materials.
So therefore, you should be able to read it on Shabbat and inside because you're forced to know this, have this knowledge.
That's true. That's true, right? He doesn't say it's because they're forced. I guess that you're right, it's true. It's not like so clear if it's really permissible to talk about this, so then it shouldn't be a problem that he has to justify they'll fall behind in school. Right? They should just be able to, it's an excellent point. Right? They should just be able to learn the material. If it's really okay to study your professional materials on Shabbat, so he doesn't need the argument, oh, you missed school on Shabbat, so you won't understand it Monday. Who needs it, right? It's okay, right? If this is permissible to talk about on Shabbat, so it's permissible. Right, so there's a lot of discomfort behind even this argument, which is a very stretched argument. Okay, so question to think about is right, why does he resort to this stretched argument after right, when he had a clear opening, right? He could have just ruled like the one who permits in Shulchan Aruch. Right, he could have just said, right, you know, they learn lots of books, lots of wisdom stuff, and that's enough. Right, he doesn't. He could have started distinguishing and say, okay, well, the stuff which is related to the profession, that they can do because of that position in Shulchan Aruch. Right? The stuff, on the other hand, which is related to professions, there's this justification. Right? He lumps everything together, right? And he says, well, in terms of justifying intellectual grounds, that's not enough. But in terms of profession, that he thinks is enough. Okay, right? So I think a really good question to think about is why is somebody who himself is committed to the value of these materials, right? Nonetheless, when it comes to law, or at least to the way he writes law, right, he writes law without any reference to the value of these materials intrinsically at all. Right, he just quotes straight Shulchan Aruch. Okay, then we get to what I think is the most stunning. I think one of the most stunning lines in his response there. Right, he says, okay, so maybe we should say some people should hire a private tutor. Right, some people, right? So the people who can afford a private tutor, so their kids don't have to go to school on Shabbat. That's fine. Right, they'll make up the material. So he says, look, most of us children are poor. Right? Most of our parents are poor. They can't hire a private tutor. Okay, that's fine. Then he says, okay, what about the people who can hire a private tutor? What should they do? Okay, and there he says that it seems to him that there are places where the people who can afford to hire tutors should send their kids to school on Shabbat. Because otherwise, the poor children will be stuck in school on Shabbat without a social support group, to prevent them, to keep them strong against writing on Shabbat. So it's very difficult to be in school and the teacher's giving out assignments and you know the teacher's going to hold it against you, right? And all your friends are wondering why aren't you doing the work? And you're going to have to spend your entire weekend just making up the material. All right? So he says, in schools where the poor children have to go to school because they can't hire tutors, the rich parents have to send the kids to school, have their kids to school also. Right, in order to create a sufficient social support group that all the children will be able to not write on Shabbat. And that's an amazing, moment. Right, then he says, look, he says, I found some kind of justification for it. We have a principle which we discussed last year that sometimes we tell one person to do a minor sin to let somebody else do it, to prevent somebody else from doing a major sin. So here it's not even a minor sin because I've come up with some kind of rationale. So of course we tell you to do it, right? And then he has this tremendous inspiration. Look, this right, people are sending their kids to school all over Germany, and they're coming out to be these wonderful flowers of the community. So you shouldn't be worried, right? Go ahead and do it. Right? This presumably is directed at the rich people. Okay. Then he says at the end, however, certainly one has to make sure they go to Hashkama. Right? The children all have to go to Hashkama, and of course they should stay home on Yom Tovim, and at least they should stay home on Yom Nora. Okay, so a number of things that I'm interested in here. Number one, Hashkama, what happened at 2 o'clock in the afternoon? Why didn't Hashkama show up in the previous Jew? Have you ever Shacharis and then go to...
They wouldn't have time.
They wouldn't have time to curse the Torah before... No, he says, right, Hashkama means so they won't miss the public Torah reading. Right, so it's clear he means waiting for Hashkama also. Yes? Yeah, but I don't know, it's like... When he's talking about Rabbi Hildesheimer's tshuva, so he doesn't mention the option of Hashkama. Right, you have to have it, because otherwise Torah reading will be forgotten. Yes, Yeshua? Why not have them say they all have to come to the afternoon Torah reading? Okay, maybe he's really uncomfortable this
time. Okay,
so maybe he's just really uncomfortable the previous Shiva. And so, look, there is an afternoon Torah reading, but if you ask me what to do, come in the morning. And, okay, yes, Josh and David.
Maybe he's not trying to address his problem, his true halakhic problem during his Torah reading, as much as he realized that by indicating this general law, the idea of Shabbos has been greatly questioned. If you're in school for 7 hours a day, and it almost sounds like coming Shabbos for these kids, so if they go to school for Torah, it's pretty easy to help create a sense of Shabbos for them. At least they start that way, it's almost like he's trying to even it out so that they keep Shabbos as Shabbos.
Okay, that's maybe thinks Shabbos first thing in the morning, the same way people fought for Jewish studies first thing in the morning in day school. Right? Yes?
Maybe it's a balance between, on the one hand, sometimes you have to suffer a person with the sake of the good of the entire community, but there are other times where your own religious development comes first, and so. Yes, you should go to school because it's important that they be, a heaven is appropriate for people not to learn on Shabbos, but you shouldn't go to the afternoon waiting. If you view from the family which had the commitment that they were considering paying a tutor for you not to listen on Shabbos, if you already have that religious commitment from your family, like, yes, you should go to school, but, you shouldn't have to go to the afternoon video.
Okay, right, maybe there are different audiences, right, that the previous tutor was talking about people who would go whether he told them to or not. And here he's talking to the people who actually care about what he said. Right, yeah?
Is it supposed to a lot to find out that aspect of it? That this is going to an apprenticeship or something that will help you earn a living? Because I'm just thinking about this in modern day terms where someone is looking for a corporation that will schedule a conference on Shabbos, and then there are issues around material that you're going to miss if you're not going to be there, how that's going to affect your.
Right. He hooked it very much to Parnassa. Now, whether talking about job promotion as opposed to getting a job at all would work for him, I don't know.
Yes. And
as long as you're not going to have to go out and engage in banditry, it might not work anymore.
Right. But, in terms of here, if you get away from the actual issue of writing or travel,
right.
Or whatever, I just wonder if it's
strongly moved. That's explicitly all he ever talks about is Parnassa.
Yeah, because the very first source. Emphasizing that so much
yeah.
about teaching your child a trade, almost like teaching Torah color or getting a white.
Right. Right. That's what he is, right? There's no mention anywhere here of the intrinsic value of study. Never shows up at all.
Yeah.
Right? As I'm interested in why that is and somebody who actually believes in it. Right? Somebody who actually did believe these kind of studies of value, why doesn't it show up in law at all?
So the potential answer to your question, you primed the possibility that that first tshuva was actually second, in which case you may have decided that or noticed that no one was coming to that shkama.
Right, that's certainly possible, right? I verily decided no one was coming to Ashkava.
That would sort of fit in with Eilas of Hashem as well.
Right.
You know, this is the right way, but...
They may have realized it didn't work. They may have realized it didn't work, absolutely. Between two different communities in Germany, right, that there are people who view this as horrible and you can't send your children, right, and he's trying to find a way to write this tshuva in a way which justifies the behavior of the parents who are doing this to the people who don't accept it. Right, so if he made it explicitly in terms of the value of intellect, so that would automatically exclude him, right? That would be sectarian halacha. Right? If you wrote a tshuva saying, I think children should go to school because I think that studying German poetry is part of Torah. Alright, so you know that everybody, right, that a vast part of the community automatically just takes this tshuva and throws it out and calls the children Mechalei Shabbat. Mm-hmm. Maybe that's the only way he can write it if he's writing for the broader community. And that's an issue. To what degree is it legitimate to hide your real rationale, right, for rhetorical purposes that way? Yes, Mary? Yes. You don't know him, right? Maybe he really didn't believe it's part of Torah, and he thinks that Shabbat is something that should be limited to Torah, not things of value. Although, right, the Gemara seems to distinguish between Chefte Shemayim and Cheftecha. Right, the Shulchan Aruch distinguishes between Torah and other things. The Gemara talks about Chefte Shemayim. So if he thinks it's Chefte Shemayim, that should be good enough, even if it's not formally Torah. Because it's not Chavetz Tefa, it's Chavetz Shemayim, right? So I don't know if you need a definition of Talmud Torah. It might be that he's just saying, well, Shulchan Aruch says Torah, and that's how the Shulchan Aruch interprets the Gemara. Maybe. And I think you have all those options.
Why does he imply that Yom Tov should be different? If anything, you can argue that Chetziel Lashem and Chetziel Lacha,
I think it's purely psychological. Purely psychological, you know. Yom Tov are these big events, and if you, right? And also, it's a lot easier. Look, that they can get there, that he can get away with. Okay. But I think it's really very practical. Okay, I want to just leave those questions open. I want to just point out what I think is two really powerful things about this tshuva that it talks about explicitly. One is the relationship between rich and poor. I think that's a tremendous thing. The notion that the rich people have a religious responsibility for the poor. To the extent that you have to do things which aren't necessarily as good religiously for your children for the sake of making sure that access to religious life is not class dependent. It's not class dependent in halakha. That's a very important claim. I think that because of the incredible prosperity in America, we really are insufficiently conscious of. I know for myself, as my family grows, start realizing what it takes to live a perfectly ordinary Orthodox Jewish life. And it takes, as a bare minimum, something like 4 times the poverty level. Which is really astounding, right? That in order to live a reasonable Orthodox Jewish life, you have to make something like, you know, at least, I think it's 4 times the poverty level and 2 or 3 times the median American income. And that, you know, we're lucky. We're lucky. I know that, you know, that all of the day school initiatives that are trying to do something about that. But that's something that really, I think that's true, which is really, in a way in which it's very modern, in a way which we haven't really come to terms with. The notion of a religious imperative to create classless access to all aspects of religiosity. The second thing, which I think is an issue which has to some degree been a defining aspect of unorthodoxy and should be more, is the question to whether halakha is paskin for the community which follows halakha, or halakha is paskin for the community as a whole. Right. There's a grave danger in paskining halakha for a community which you think obeys halakha, which really doesn't. Right, you know, coming up with heterion for people who won't listen anyway. That's not what I think he's doing. But the notion that when you paskin, you have to take into account the effect of your psak, not just on the people who listen to it, but on the people who won't listen to it. Right, that, I think, is something that is, right, is a moral imperative based on certain values that, at least in theory, modern orthodoxy really is strongly attached to. And there are advantages and disadvantages to both methods. An example of the catch-22 involved in this is Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's response about non-orthodox weddings. Rabbi Moshe Feinstein wrote a tshuva, a tremendously significant tshuva, you know, maybe the tshuva which is the only hope of keeping a unified Jewish people, in which he argued that all non-orthodox weddings are ipso facto invalid, and therefore you never have to worry about mamzerut from children of second marriages, where the first marriage wasn't orthodox. It's a tremendous response to them, and without it, you know, we'd have crises all over the Baal Shuva movement that people coming out of it suddenly discovered, right, were halachically unmarriageable. That we'd have, as bad as who as a Jew is, it would be much, much worse if there weren't this response from Rav Moshe. On the other hand, in order to get away with writing this, which is an extraordinary halachic leap, he had to include 3 pages of invective about non-orthodox Judaism. I don't think he included it for pragmatic purposes, I think he really believed it. But it had to be in the tshuva. So, ironically, there are a whole series of articles in non-orthodox periodicals attacking Rabbi Feinstein for his divisive rhetoric. It's true, it's a divisive rhetoric, but it's divisive rhetoric which is the only possibility, which creates the possibility of non-divisive halakha. The question is, so on the one hand, that's a wonderful example of really caring about how your psak affects the rest of the community. On the other hand, it was assumed that the tshuva would only be read, right? In terms of its result, it was tremendously sensitive to that. In terms of its rhetoric, it assumed that it would never get out, and that was a mistake. Because in fact, it's one of the few tshuvot you'll ever read in non-orthodox rabbinic school. It's Rabbi Feinstein's tshuva about non-orthodox weddings. When I go to Wexner things, that's the tshuva everybody's read, without understanding at all what the impact of it is. They only understand the rhetoric. But I think, pardon? Yeah, so then I try and say, look, you know, if you want, you care about one Jewish people, then you darn better be doing everything you can. There's a former rabbi friend of mine and I, we're going to put out a joint paper that says frequently, suggesting that for the same goal that the Reform marriage ceremony be amended to say, Shelo Kedat Moshe v'Yisrael. To remove, right, because he wanted it to make sure that no one would think that they actually endorsed the standards of sexist procedure, and I wanted it to make sure that no one, that everybody could pass him like Rav Moshe without qualm. So we're going to see it, if we could, because I used to have long conversations with my teachers desperately trying to convince them to pass him like Rav Moshe, and people wouldn't be willing to. Rav Aaron Soloveitchik and Shir telling us about how he went back to wedding pictures to see if there were any frum people who might have had a sight line to the chuppah, and how he once managed to makir somebody because everyone in the Kalas family was 6 feet tall and nobody was frum, and they ring the chuppah, so nobody else could possibly have gotten any kind of look in. I remember watching a video once, desperately hoping that the Masada Kedushin would make some kind of error. Did he ask who was his ring? Darn, he asked who was his ring. Did he make sure that was the only two witnesses? Yeah, he made sure it was only two witnesses. And got lucky on that one, I hope, by finally asking the person when he got married, being told, if you were married, you broke the glass, of course. And he had no understanding that the ring was actually supposed to affect the marriage. He was just engaging in some kind of general procedure. So I don't know if that worked or not. That would be a daily synopsis for getting out of that particular marriage. But I think that Rabbi Hoffman here, right, is very much, I say, in terms of the treatment of the issue of the value of study for its own sake, I think it's something that provokes thought, right? Why doesn't he ever mention, by the way, I think that it's really cool that they go to public school because they learn things which I think they should learn, right? And that's why I'm in favor of gymnasium, right? He never talks about I'm in favor of gymnasium in general. He never mentions it at all. I think it's worth thinking about why. But I think that the other issue which really comes out of here is his sense of responsibility within the community across economic levels, and the stock has to be conscious of the different economic circumstances of people whom it's facing, right, which is not a chiddush. Rabbi Yeshua has a wonderful line when Rabbi Gamliel comes to appease him, and Rabbi Gamliel walks in and sees Rabbi Yeshua's house is black, and he says, "I see you must be a blacksmith because the walls of your house are black." And Rabbi Yeshua says, "Woe to the generation that you're the leader of if you don't know what people need to do to make a living, right? Because you can't really be an effective leader if you don't understand the economic circumstances of the community." So to that extent, I think it's a wonderful model. But I think that, and really on the value level, it's a tremendously important model in the sense that when you paskin, you can't just say, look, I'm going to make the decision and whoever follows, right? But you have to have responsibility for all the Jewish community, with a very good non-naive realization of who it is who cares about what you're writing, and who it is who does. Yeah. Well, take it as far as you want. You could also say that he would have closed day schools on the grounds that all the Jewish children in public school. Right? Who could use? Right? Who knows? Right? So you can take the argument as far as you want. You can say, you know, send your children to the weaker school in your community as opposed to the stronger school which is outside your community. Right? Even within your community, you know, send to the community that you really believe in as opposed to the community you don't really believe in, even though the Jewish education is stronger. Right? There are lots of different ways you can take it. Right? So there are the way to make this tshuva really unpopular in modern orthodoxy would be to say, you know, here we have an attack on day school. Right? The way to make it really popular is to say, here we have an attack against sending your children to right-wing schools, right, as opposed to modern orthodox school in town. And I don't know which way he would have made the decision. Since I'm into, you know, restoring his cachet, let's suppose that he's for day schools and against sending your children. All right, thank you. You've been a great audience.
Thank you.